Okay, we're going to go by my clock because Siri tells me what time it is if I ask her. Yeah, so, and I refuse to fall in love with a disembodied voice. Let me just point out that, as usual, obligatory yes, do sign in sheets are coming around the room. And so we'll just start it again. If you've already signed, you don't have to sign twice, but if you haven't signed in, please do. Those are coming around. Just send them. What's that? You know, they'll circulate, not unlike, you know, when you're at a concert and somebody starts doing beach balls, the sign-in sheets are a lot like that.
That's certainly not where I thought he was going.
Okay. Anyway, well, my name is John Beck, and I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives with my brother-in-arms, Kurt Dewhurst. And for 20 years, Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives has tried to preserve, present, promote a workers' culture in a variety of different ways. And I could not be more pleased with what we've got going on today when I get to introduce Yishay Barnwell, Dr. Yishay Barnwell, in a moment. But some quick announcements of things coming up. This is where I cue my friends the Greenwoods, who always are happy enough to just start the flyers going. Next week, back across in our normal room at the MSU Museum, Shanghaied in Hoboken, Asian Sailors as Workers and Immigrants, with Anna Pegler-Gordon from James Madison College on campus. Fabulous, fabulous scholar and a great presenter. Unfortunately, our February 20th, for those of you who keep one of our lists on your refrigerator, our 20th of February program with Catherine Silva Banks on African-American women in textile and also Cape Verdean women in textile, that's been canceled, and we have to put that into next year. At the end of the month, or close to the end of the month, February 24th, Chantel Tatro will be talking about everyday translations, practices, and challenges among Muslim Arab public sector workers in France, which I think will be very, very interesting. And then coming around is our full schedule. Tonight is, we'll talk about tonight is the community, Midwinter Community Sing. And it is one of the greatest events kind of in the calendar. And Dr. Barnwell is tonight's song leader. And it's not only tonight, but it's tomorrow night. And it's all sorts of workshops tomorrow, including our friend Verlaine. And I think that it's just an unbelievable event in the community. And we look forward to seeing you there tonight and tomorrow night and during the day tomorrow and so forth. But little yellow flyers went around that describe that more in depth. So let me first of all thank the co-sponsors for today, which is the MSU Colloquial Series and the MSU Division of Occupational Environmental Medicine, because we have some wonderful folks working in that whole area here, and they were very interested in this. And we're recording the program today, like we do all the time. You can go anytime to the MSU Library website, put in Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, and the entire list of all the ones that we've recorded will come up. And then you just go to the individual one, and there's a little section in the middle that says, Listen Now. Pop that, and you can comes up on your computer anywhere across the globe. And so we do hope that you take advantage of that and have students and others, friends and family. So today, Dr. Yishay Barnwell was one of the founders of one of the most iconic single singing groups of the 20th and now into the 21st century, Sweet Honey and the Rock. Sweet Honey and the Rock, I think for a lot of us, was our almanac singers, our weavers, in terms of the power that they had to really inform the public, you know, and witness to the public and to audiences and work in a variety of different settings, and just so well. And Dr. Barnwell actually came to music early as a daughter of a classical violinist, and took up the violin herself. did a number of different degrees in speech pathology, and was one of the founders of Sweet Honey in the Rock, pushed the whole notion that there should be signers at every concert. They were one of the, I think, first very, very important groups to establish that, to make sure that the whole concert experience was accessible to more than just those who are able to hear. So today, she's going to help us understand a whole canon of music, occupational music, and specifically in the lives of some specific work groups who had their lives caught up in the way that that music talked not only about their work lives, but the health and safety on the job, the danger of what it meant to be a minor, and everything else. So she's going to help us understand that by talking on this subject, More Than a Paycheck, What Occupational Music Reveals About Worker Health. So please help me in welcoming to our daily work, our daily lives, Dr. Yusei Barnwell.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Fine. Thank you all for coming.
It's warm today. Sorry.
I know. I actually took off my jacket in here. I've been wearing 3 and 4 layers everywhere, every day. So I'm glad it's warmer today. Thank you very, very much for inviting me to come and talk to you. I have to make one major correction, and that is that I was not a founding member of Sweet Honey in the Rock. It was 6 years old when I actually joined. I joined in 1979, and the group started in 1973. So the group is now celebrating 40 years, and I retired in May, so I'm a former member of the group. I've had a strange history with music. For a period of time, I left it. I studied the violin for 17 years. I sang in junior high school. I sang through college and played the guitar and all of that. And then I left it. And I taught for 12 years at Howard University College of Dentistry. And I left there after 12 years and decided that I would go back to school to do a postdoc in public health. And that was in 1980. So the study that I'm going to talk about or reference was done in 1980. I joined Sweet Honey in 79. And in 1980, Sweet Honey went to Japan. And something there triggered something for me, which kind of led to the study that I want to talk about. I'm looking around the room, and I'm really excited because I think some of you may remember a song that went like this. 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and a deeper in debt. Same people, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. Well, I was a kid, you know, when that came out, and it was like on the charts. Tennessee Ernie Ford. And he had this deep voice, which I really liked. And so it kind of stuck with me. But at the time, you know, I didn't really know what a company store was. I didn't really understand that this was, quote unquote, technically an occupational song. It was just a popular song, and it was really cool. And around the same time, there were other songs that kind of hit the charts, and one was, I'm gonna jump down, spin around, pick a bale of cotton, gonna jump down, spin around, pick a bale of day, gonna jump down, spin around, pick a bale of cotton, gonna jump down, spin around, pick a day. And I thought, well, that's a cool song too. And they all just kind of went inside and stayed there. And bless you. And so I had a lot of stuff running around. When I was in junior high school, I sang in a choir that only did spirituals. And those were running around. And these things all kind of, I think, began to make sense to me years later. When I went to public health school, I had no idea what I was going to do my research in. And I had to ask permission. This was an intensive 10-month project program. And I had to ask permission to leave for a month because Sweet Honey was going to Japan. And at that point, I still had not chosen what my research was going to be on. So I was in a devil of a fix, as my father used to say. But we had just studied Minamata. Some of you know about Minamata. It's in Japan. And the waters in Japan were, in Minamata at least, were infused with chemicals. And the fish ate the chemicals in the form of mercury. And then the people ate the fish. And then the mercury began to take its effect. Strange things would happen, like cats would start shaking on the street and then just drop dead. And people started trying to figure out what on earth was happening until they realized that in fact, a large percentage of the population had mercury poisoning. So we had just studied about that at the point that Sweet Honey was going to Japan. And I was so excited because as part of my plea, I could say, we're going to Minamata. And in my brain, I'm thinking, do I want to go there? Can I drink the water there? Can I eat the fish there? It was some years later, but I still had those concerns. But they let me go. And so when we got to Minamata, I started asking, did anybody write any songs about what happened here? And people kept saying no, which I thought was very, very strange. And at that point, I began to understand that I had come out of a legacy where African Americans wrote songs about everything that happened in life, everything. I personally define spirituals as the body of song created during the period of enslavement. That means that all the children's songs, all the work songs, all the laments, the sorrow songs, all of those are part of the body of songs that I refer to as spirituals. And so what I had always thought since I had put that together for myself was, in fact, we had used music to document our entire existence since coming here. We had done that in Africa, and we didn't leave it. We brought it with us when we came. And so here we have this vast body of songs that talk about everything. And so if you have a song that says, I'm going to jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton, we have a sense of what that work was like. We have a sense of take this hammer, carry it to the captain, take this hammer, you know. And so we have a large body of these songs. And I realized I had been hearing them and singing a few of them and for a long time. And so to go to a place where I was asking about an event that was so big and to have people say no, they didn't know of any songs that had been written was really peculiar. So I thought, wow, all right, this is giving me a clue about something that I might deal with. But in public health school, I have no idea how they're going to go for me researching occupational songs. You know, they're going to say, what's that got to do with anything? But actually, they were wiser than I thought. Or they just thought I was weird and they let me go. And by the time I got back, I knew that what I wanted to do was to look at some aspect of labor songs, work songs, occupational songs, to see how different health conditions, how different work conditions, et cetera, were documented. Ordinary songs, and that's the important part, just ordinary songs, nothing that you have to go digging for generations to find. And I was fortunate. Everybody said they didn't know who would supervise my research. And a person who had retired named Paul Cornelli, who had been the president of American Public Health Association and was African American, when he heard that this is what I wanted to do, he said, oh, I'll come back and I'll supervise your research. Yes. Okay, so I decided that I would look at two occupations that I could compare, that one was primarily a male occupation, the other was primarily a female occupation. So I looked at coal mining and textile working. I decided also that I wanted to use only or to refer only to songs that I could find in those days in record stores. Like if I went through the bins, I could just look at the titles and see, oh, that's about coal mining. Oh, that one, it's about textiles. Things that were really accessible, because I was looking for a way to include music in public health education. That was really my goal. And I realized that I had already experienced this. How many of you remember the songs that talked about how you cross the street when you're a child? Cross on the green and not in between. And other songs like that. I mean, you learn these things and you sort of absorb them without even thinking about it. And I thought, maybe what we need to do is place these songs consciously so that we know that people are getting exposed to them and will think about them in certain ways, and then we can reference them in conscious ways. So I started going to record stores and collecting titles of songs. I went to bookstores and I bought song books and looked for titles. I came up with 90 coal mining songs and 50 textile working songs. I thought, okay, that's not bad. And then I started looking at how could I categorize these materials. Well, there are work songs, there are occupational songs, there are work-related songs, there are labor songs. And I had to figure out how to make some distinctions so that, you know, there was a language that was fairly consistent throughout the whole study. So work songs are songs actually that accompany work most of the time. If you're a sailor or if you row a boat, then those songs are going to accompany the rowing, or those songs are going to accompany the breaking of the rocks, or those songs, that, you know, they're going to accompany what you're doing. So that's how I defined work songs. Work-related songs are songs that kind of talk about the issues of the work that's done. And occupational songs are usually pretty clearly defined in terms of, are we talking about boatmen? Are we talking about coal miners, or are we talking about textile workers? So you understand the difference in the songs that the kinds of songs that I was looking at. And what I began to find was very, very interesting. That there were some things that coal mining songs had in common with textile working songs based on the impact of the work on the worker. The key things, and then they start to go off in different directions. The key things had to do with respiratory issues. Brown lung out of the textile working and black lung out of coal mining. The symptoms are very, very similar, that one begins to have a tight chest, one can't catch one's breath, there's pressure on the lungs, et cetera, and they have no good end. Essentially, there were songs about brown lung. There were songs about black lung. But then there are other songs that described other things, like the working conditions. Okay, there are coal mining songs that talk about every job in coal mining. So if you are at the surface of the land, of the mine, chances are your symptoms are going to be much less than those who go deep down into the mines. The dangers increase as you go deeper and deeper. Okay? That kind of gradation doesn't really happen around textile working. But there are some, there are accidents that can happen in both. Now, the degree of accidents in coal mining can include huge explosions, can include people who fall off of the cars that take you down into the mines, or you can be struck by one of those cars and injured or killed. So there are a number of different kinds of accidents that can take place in coal mining. When you think about textile working, you don't really think very much about accidents. But some of the accidents that can happen have to do with having a needle go into your finger. Doesn't sound so severe, but it led to another observation. And this came out of a song that was popular in the around 1980 when I was doing this study. And it talked about boredom. Whoever looked at boredom as a major problem in an industry. So there are songs that talk about the fact that, you know, I dream all day and my mind goes off and I keep, you know, doing what I'm doing until it's time to go home. Zap, needle in the finger. We don't think much about that, but it's a very important thing. And so I was looking at accidents in both industries. I was looking at the symptoms of the diseases, when these things had their onset, and various other factors that I could kind of pull together. I want to share a few things with you that I found. Okay. In coal mining and textile working, if we compare the two industries, again, male, female, coal mining songs, they talk about boys and men, because sometimes, very often, men would take their sons with them into the mines. They could fit into spaces that adults could not fit into, subjecting them actually to some of the more dangerous aspects of the job, which is, we don't really process that. Bless you. Textile workers, women would take their daughters very often. But fortunately, the kinds of accidents weren't nearly as severe. The biggest accident, and I know all of you know about this, the biggest accident and the one that's recorded in song is around the textile, triangle textile factory, okay? And was that 1913? I believe, and so there are some songs about that that refer to it, but that is the biggest accident, fortunately, that is discussed in the songs and in the literature. But when you look at the mining disasters, they are numerous, and there are songs about mining disasters in a number of different cities. So when we look at the diseases, there are two different names, and I met a man at Highlander Center, and he was just this kind of elfish kind of man. He was a lot of fun. But he implanted something for me in a song that he sang. Pneumoniconiosis, a black lung. And every time now that I look at the word, I want to say pneumoniconiosis, but it's pneumoconiosis. And the textile word is byssinosis. So those are the two terms, medical terms, that are applied to the dust, the kinds of diseases that come from the dust in both of these places. Racially, blacks were essentially excluded from the mines in Pennsylvania and New York and in those regions, but they did hire blacks in Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia. Those numbers decreased significantly. And until 1980, the numbers didn't start to increase again. Black women did not go into the textile industry in large numbers. 145 women were killed in the Triangle fire. But in terms of going into the mills, the textile mills, mostly those were white women until more recently. The health, a state of, there's a definition of health that I really like that comes out of public health, and it says that it's a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. That's a definition that we generally don't adhere to, but I like it because it not only is much more inclusive, but it also talks about individuals and groups, the individual and the community that the individual comes from. And that's really, really an important aspect of health. And so when we talk about prevention of disease, we're talking not only of individuals, but we're talking about community-wide and groups as well. Let's see where I am right now. The songs as data, I think, were important because they were created by the people that I was looking at. So it's not as if the data was created by somebody else looking from a distance, but these people were writing about their own experiences and documenting them in an amazing kind of accuracy. And a lot of times that kind of data is not as respected as when someone who is quote unquote impartial goes in and looks at the data. But these songs are very, very important. Okay, I wanna switch gears here for just a second and look at some of the lyrics so that you have a sense of some of this material. Okay, let's see if I can pull this together. I had to choose a time period for looking at the research. And that was because I wanted songs that were written in this country. A lot of the songs prior to, say, 1840 were written by people who had immigrated to this country and brought their songs. So I wanted to look at a period of time that actually said, no, these songs are from people in this country. Okay, let me try to scan through here. All right. Let me just read the lyrics to this. I don't know the melodies of all of these songs, but I'd like to read the lyrics. The women and the children, their hearts were filled with joy to see the men go to work again, and likewise every boy. But a dismal sight in broad daylight soon made them turn pale when they saw the breakers burning or the mines of Avondale. From here and there and everywhere, they gathered in a crowd, some tearing off their clothes and hair and crying out aloud, "Get out, our husbands, get out, our sons. Death is going to steal their lives away without delay in the mines of Avondale." A consultation was then held. 'Twas asked who'd volunteer for to go down this dismal shaft to seek their comrades dear. Two Welshmen, brave without dismay, a courage without fail, went down the shaft without delay in the mines of Avondale. When at the bottom they arrived and thought they might make their way, one of them died for want of air, while the other, in great dismay, he gave a sign to hoist him up to tell the dreadful tale that all were lost forever in the mines of Avondale. Every effort then took place to send down some fresh air. The men that next went down again, they took of them good care. They traversed through chambers and this time did not fail in finding those dead bodies in the mines of Avondale. So not only does it tell the story, but it gives you some clues about the kinds of dangers that go you know, you're not just working, but even when you go to try to rescue someone, you putting yourself in danger may not come back alive. 67 was the number that in a heap were found. They seemed they were bewailing their fate in underground. They found the father with his son clasped in his arms so pale. It was a heart-rending scene in the minds of Avondale. Now to conclude and make an end, their number I'll pin down. 110 brave stout men were smothered underground. In their graves till this last day, their widows will bewail. And the orphans' cries then rend the skies all around Avondale. I think mining clearly was the most dangerous work in the country for a very, very long time, and the songs all say that. One of the things that are talked about in songs of coal miners as well as textile workers is noise. But the noise was greater in the textile factories than it was in the mines. And so you have women writing about the noise. This one says, "She'll sing aloud for none can hear. So noisy goes the mill." Wow. More people are exposed to damaging noise in the textile industry than any other industry. And yet, there were no songs that talked about deafness or hearing loss, which I found very interesting. And deafness and hearing loss has been an interest of mine for a while. There are many more songs in coal mining that talk about organizing around the issues, that talk about the wages, that talk about the hours. This song says, "Rock dust has almost killed me. It's turned me out in the rain, for dust has settled in my lungs and causes me constant pain." And that's coal mining. This is a cotton song, because it's card room, spinning room, winding room, weave room, lint all over my shoes. When I get to the other side, gonna tell them about the cotton mill blues. So, you know, goodbye Monday blues, goodbye card room fever. Cotton dust has got to my lungs, and now I'm bound to leave you. So in their songs, they're anticipating their end, which is really tragic. And the end does not include going and getting treated. It just includes dying, and that's really sad. Where it's dark as a dungeon and damp as the dew, where the dangers are double and the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines, it's dark as a dungeon way down in the mines, where the demons of death often come by surprise, one fall of the slate and you're buried alive. This is a textile song. 10 hours a day of labor in a close, ill-lighted room. Machinery's abuzz for music, waste gassed for sweet perfume. Hot, stifling vapors in summer, chill drafts on a winter day. No pause for rest or pleasure on pain of being sent away. So I could go on. Clearly, there were 90 coal mining songs and there were 50 textile songs. So there are quite a few to go through here. Sure.
Do you think the difference, the 90 and the 50, how do you account for that difference? Because one was truly more dramatically dangerous than the other, or because one was male occupation, one was female occupation, and there were more songwriters maybe than people?
I think the sexual difference makes a significant difference. I also think that the impact of coal mining disasters, accidents, et cetera, had to be recorded, you know? I mean, there were many more mine explosions, and for almost every explosion, for almost every accident, someone documented it. And since there weren't as significant accidents in the female textile working, I think it may have felt like there wasn't that much to document. But in spite of that, there are still many. So, yeah, I think the male versus female and the dangers, the extent of the dangers made the difference in the number of songs. Yeah. Anybody else at this point? Okay. Here is someone describing their physical difficulties. This person says, the last time I went near my job, I thought my lungs were broken. Chest bound down like iron bands. I couldn't breathe for choking. Here's another song. I went to the doctor, couldn't hardly catch my breath. The doctor said, you got something that well could mean your death. With this pneumoniconiosis, the black lung blues, if you got one, you got the other. Anyway, you lose. It's not hopeful. There's nothing hopeful about it. It's just a matter of fact. And so, at the point that I was working on this, Congress was actually debating giving up some of the restrictions and that had been placed and some of the advantages in terms of pay and compensation and things like that. They were actually debating that. And the interesting thing is I would go sometimes to meetings of coal miners and the room would be filled with smoke. And that really was significant to me because how then were they going to prove that it was the occupation that caused their disease? Even though everything was very clear, but if you're a smoker and you've been smoking for life and you sit in smoke-filled rooms all the time, how do you make the case? It's very difficult, very, very difficult. He's a poor man, because mining's all he's known, and miners don't get rich loading coal. He's a sick man, because that coal dust took its stand, but he doesn't expect no help from that operator man. The other aspect that I didn't mention yet has to do with the company town. And that goes back to Tennessee Ernie Ford. It was interesting to me to learn what that meant, what it was meant by living in a company town where the company actually owned and controlled everything. And where there was a script that you used in place of money, where you could use up all your script, before the month was half over, and then you'd be in debt. And you don't get out of debt once you get into it. There's no way to do that. And so there are these vicious cycles, which, we still see these vicious cycles today, even though we don't have company towns anymore. But in those times, that was all there was. The company town owned everything and everybody. I really like this mill worker song, and this is a contemporary song. This was written, I think, 79 or 80. Mill work ain't easy. Mill work ain't hard. Mill work ain't nothing but an awful, boring job. I'm waiting for the daydream to take me through the morning and put me in my coffee break, where I can have a sandwich and remember. It's so clearly feminine. But when you think about the impact of boredom, it just really, it can take your breath away. And some of us work in boring jobs. You live in the company houses. You go to the company school. You're working for the company according to company rules. You drink the company water. You use company lights. Company preachers teach us, and company thinks it's right, what the company thinks is right. One of the last ones I'll read. When my husband works in the coal mine, he loads a car most every trip. Then he goes to the office that evening and gets denied his script. Just because it took all he made that day to pay his mine expense. A man that'll work for the coal light and carbides ain't got a lick of sense. This mining town I live in is a dead and lonely place where pity and starvation are pictured on every face. Oh, listen, friends and workers, please take a friend's advice. Don't load no more. Don't pull no more till you get your living price. So that gives you a sense of some of the songs. The question then for me was, okay, so what is this thing about public health and public health education? And is there a way that these materials can be used to help people in community begin to understand what the issues are? The thing about the songs that I really like is that they're based in a community. They come out of a community. So if you hear them playing, for example, in a doctor's office, you're hearing your neighbor. You're hearing about issues that you are familiar with because you've grown up with it. But maybe in that particular context, it might give you a sense of identity to hear over the speaker what it is you're suffering with, to actually acknowledge that there are accidents that happen, to actually acknowledge that you have something that your neighbor has. So I wanted to suggest, what should I do? I think it's me. Okay. I wanted to suggest that these kinds of songs be played in public places, and that they also be played on community radio stations. It would not necessarily happen on commercial radio stations, because the one or two get through. Like that Millworker song was, you know, fairly popular. I heard that on the radio, but one doesn't get a consistent exposure. So I wanted to suggest that songs be played in schools, songs be played on community radio, songs be played in meeting halls, songs be played in doctor's offices where people would go to be treated for these kinds of things. And that, in fact, there be a move to kind of really expose people to their own language, in a way, if you understand what I mean. And then to use the lyrics of songs in the teaching of poetry and other written things, to have young people begin to write about the things they've heard, about the things they've experienced that really, really are a danger to their community life, their work life, et cetera. When I did my defense of the research, I gave the faculty 10 songs of coal miners and 10 songs of textile workers, and took out the names, any names of the disease. And based on what the songs might have said about the onset of breathing difficulties, the descriptions, obviously, of certain kinds of accidents. I mean, I didn't do the major explosions because that's a dead giveaway. So I tried to include songs that had more subtle things. But the faculty in every instance was able to determine whether these were coal mining songs or whether these were textile working songs. It wasn't all that hard, believe me. But at least, you know, I think it surprised them because they hadn't really given any thought to it and to the fact that this information is so readily accessible. And that was a big point in terms of what I wanted to actually go through. So at the end of that, I asked them to sing a song that I had written on the occasion of having done this study, and that song was called More Than a Paycheck, because what became clear to me was that almost every occupation has its hazards. And I wanted people to know that. And I wanted people to understand that some things that I think plague our society today are less obvious than in days of yore. Tension and stress, I think, play a really huge part in alcoholism, drug abuse, et cetera. And so if we are engaging in those behaviors, we are again setting ourselves up for things that contradict our strides towards moving into a healthy environment. So the song goes like this, and I hope you will join me. It says, we bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. That's the whole chorus, okay? And then it goes on to say, we bring asbestosis, silicosis, brown lung, back lung disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. I wanted more pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that man's door, you know I'm bringing home asbestosis, silicosis, brown lung, black lung disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. There's another verse, but at least you have the chorus there. So I, you know, I feel fortunate that I was a member of a group that would sing that song, because it kind of gave me a platform to say, we need to be very conscious of the kind of work we do. We need to be very conscious of the things that stress us out. And we need to acknowledge that there are relationships between what we do and how we respond to our families and to our friends, et cetera. And it was really, I think, kind of a blessing to me to have that kind of a forum where we could just sort of put it out there and say to people, please be careful. Please look after yourselves and your families, maybe in ways that you haven't thought to do so before. So I'm going to stop here, and if there are questions or if I can answer you in any way, yes. Yes. Actually, there was not. There was not a lot of recycling. The melodies were very original. Yes. I can't give you any examples, really, of repeated melodies or, you know, reworked melodies until we kind of get into the civil rights era, where group singing becomes a fairly common kind of phenomena. And then you do have people writing new lyrics for songs that everybody knows. And I think that was really good, because people were really invested at that point in unions and really wanting to pull themselves together as a group. And I think that was helpful to do, to bring new words to melodies that people already knew. But by and large, historically, the melodies were very, very individual. No, but I'm glad you asked that, because I think that as I was going through those record bins, I found songs for 48 other occupations, including prostitution, other occupations in general. And, you know, my goal then was to continue the research and then to try to publish the results, so that people would have a sense that there were lots and lots of songs that could be brought to this kind of public health education project. As things went, that didn't happen, but it's still an interest of mine. Yeah, so. Oh yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. So there are lots, yes.
So prior to those textile songs, is there much history or documentation of history of white women writing songs about occupation or situation?
You mean prior to the textile?
Right.
I can't really answer that because I was so intent on looking at the textile songs that I can't really let you know about other occupations. Certainly that, you know, might have been created in any number. I don't think I can answer that.
But in just one aside, since women were often anonymous, right? So in that way, very well may be that there were various things that were written penned by women, but we don't necessarily know that they were penned by women.
Right.
Other questions? Bad work?
Well, I was just going to say, in response to your question, that even you dealt with what you could find in the record rack, but you deal in the realm of oral tradition, and I couldn't quite hear you, but I mean, people like Aunt Molly Jackson,
yes,
Oda were writing songs about coal miners and mining. So
that's right. Absolutely.
I was going to ask you if you never got any traction for your idea about using some of this material in schools and you know, for the public education and you were talking about, because it strikes me the era that you were doing this study. I was also in graduate school, and you would see things in the field of ethnomusicology about using traditional
right.
Of using various types of popular and traditional culture, including music, for educating about health and other kinds of issues in other countries. It's not something that we've done that much here. I just wondered if you tried to implement what you were talking about.
No, I didn't. There was a circumstance for why I went into this public health program, and the occasion of doing this research, but it really didn't allow me to spend time afterwards trying to really implement this. And I'm not aware of anybody who sort of tuned in and took it from there. I think it might have to be something that I, you know, generate now that maybe I have a... I can't say I have more time now, I don't. I actually have less time now, so I'm not sure. But it certainly is something that I want to talk to people about. You know, I'm really kind of glad for this occasion because I haven't really spoken about this since the 80s when I did the work. So it's something that I've thought about, but I have not taken the advantage of it. Yes?
Do you revisit the public health issue in Japan and to see if there have been any songs written since you left?
No, I did not. I did not.
I wonder if they did pick up on your idea or your suggestion.
Right. You know, I don't know how broadly that suggestion got spread. It was just saying, really? No songs. There were other things that were going on in Japan. Like, I remember a really curious session where some Japanese feminists wanted to get together with Sweet Honey, and they were astonished at how we would walk on the stage and sing, like, with such big voices. And we talked for 3 hours, and we could not get them to speak above a whisper. You know, and the conversation was, but you have to be able to take over space with your voice. You have to be able to do that. You know, we did exercises with them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but it didn't really help. I don't know enough about Japanese tradition to know things in which they document in song. And I would need to kind of go into that. Yeah, yes.
Which was her sort of breakthrough in composing out of the North American medium and blending to Japanese instruments.
Wow.
So that came out in the
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it was just not a song exactly, but, you know, beautiful response to the disaster.
Okay, thank you. I will try to find that. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah.
Cool.
She was winning the best big band poll for several years in the 1970s. Akiyoshi,
okay. Great, thank you. Thank you.
Other questions? I have a personal question just because you might have run across.
Mm-hmm. And then there are some back here, too.
Did you run across a song for the Hawknest Valley Bridge miners who were, you know, all got silicosis from putting the tunnel through the river?
I did not. That doesn't mean it didn't exist, clearly. It just means that in my thumbing through, and I just want to, you know, repeat that I wanted to prove to people that you collect data in accessible places. And that's the reason it was like, let's go through the record bins, let's look at the song books, et cetera. But if you have to go beyond that, people are going to say, it's too difficult. You know, we don't have the time to do that. So, you know, clearly, I think there's so much more that wasn't included in this, but could have been. Hi. I need a big voice from you.
You did, like, to the research you did with the songs, did you go through any, like, internet sources or other books?
Back then, we didn't have that. I'm old in that way. And so, books. We had books. and song books. No, that's a great question. I wish we did have the internet. It would be so easy to find these things now. I was thinking that today as I was kind of thinking about how I wanted to talk about this. It would be so easy, yes?
And I think the crux of the question is, did you have to do a lot of external to the songs themselves, did you have to do a lot of community research sort of about what they were singing about to understand enough of the context out of which the songs came?
The thing is that the songs are such complete stories in most instances that you could understand, you could learn so much just from the text of the songs. And I did. I went to meetings. There was a demonstration in DC that took place while I was working on this. And people sang, you know, in the meetings, in the same way, very similar to the civil rights movement, you know, for about an hour before any talking started, you know? And many things get recounted in the songs. And so the songs themselves are just a fount of knowledge. They really are. The documentation is very accurate and very profound in many ways. So, yeah, it really is something.
There have been a number of questions about Japan, but I'm wondering if you've entertained doing comparative research with Africa. Because I think about the griot tradition, there's the praise tradition of griots in West Africa. But if you listen to the griot songs that are coming out of places like Mali, now often they talk about events.
Absolutely.
Public life and struggles of people. And the government of West Africa has specifically employed griots to do public health messaging. And so
I'm aware of that, and certainly as relates to HIV/AIDS. Yes, I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware of griots. And griots, for those of you who may not be familiar, they are the history bearers. And so, you know, if you go to them and you want to know about your ancestry or events that happened, significant events that happened in the past, they will recite from the beginning of time to that day. You know, and you can pay them and they'll add you. It's a little more of a commercial venture now than it used to be. But I was aware, not just in West Africa, but in East Africa as well, in Uganda. I talked to a lot of people about that, and was the use of music there is much more common in terms of its acceptance as a way of educating people. Here, we just aren't as conscious of it, you know? That was the thing that really blew me away when I was thinking about 16 Tons. It's like, it was right there in our faces, but I'd never heard adults talking about it, you know, and it was all over the radio. So I think that in many countries, I would not hesitate to say, all over Africa, that music is used in very functional ways. I don't know if any of you will come to my workshop on Saturday, I guess it is. But what I do in my 5-day workshops is to start in Africa with a discussion of an African worldview. And then I explain to people that we didn't leave that worldview behind when we were brought here. We brought the worldview, and what you're seeing, whether it starts, you know, in the spiritual, which I've defined already for you, and goes up to hip hop, we're still doing it. We're still operating out of an African worldview. And it's a really essential difference between Western thought and Western uses of music and African-American uses of music in that way. So yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
Other questions? I'll bring the microphone around. Anyone else? Okay, let me do a commercial. Talk about, you know, commercial. There are wonderful CDs and books, and I forgot to say that she's a children's author on top of everything else. There's some examples back there, I believe. Tonight, 8 o'clock, Hannah Community Center. Come out to the community, sing. I think it will be an absolutely wonderful thing. As you've heard, workshops tomorrow, concert again tomorrow night with different song leaders. And come next week to hear Anna Pegler Gordon talk about Asian sailors. But please join me in giving one last wonderful round of applause for a fabulous brown bag experience. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you all very much.